Norm's Conceptual Corner.
Well, good morning, everybody, or afternoon, or evening, whatever, wherever you are at. This is a new episode of Norm's Conceptual Corner. Getting to the end of the ethics course series, aren't we, Nick?
We're closing in. I can see the finish line.
Yeah. So joining me today is, of course, Nick Arcus.
Hey, everyone. This is the sound of my voice.
And for the first time, my wife Laura is joining us on this conversation.
Thank you for the invite. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us.
What?
Nick said thanks for joining us.
Oh, okay. Yep. I got it. Thanks. Well, I'll just edit that out. Not the nice part. The my not listening part.
Yeah, edit out the part where I and thank her for joining us.
So the topic today is the war on drugs. I like incorporating this into my ethics courses because it's known to be a real problem in the United States. Something that seems to treat people unfairly and harshly. And, you know, there are just, I think awareness of this problem has grown over the past 10, 15 years in the public. Perhaps mostly, or to a large extent, because of the change in the law here in the state of Colorado. I think that has brought a lot of awareness to the issue of drug use and whether it being illegal is the best solution, or is there, what exactly is the problem, too.
Certainly brought a lot of tourism.
Yeah, that's something that people in other states might not know or be aware of. Us in Colorado, we're really aware of that there are people coming here to take advantage of the legalization of marijuana. So, but you know, this episode is not going to be just about marijuana. In fact, when I was teaching ethics, I told my students that they couldn't write a paper just on legalizing marijuana because the paper is just not interesting enough at this point. There's not a whole lot of good argumentation out there against it.
What was that article with the Onion or one of the local newspapers a year after the law had gone into effect? And they said that, you know, Colorado didn't blow up the planet,
right,
or something like that. It was very sarcastic. And I thought, well, that kind of pinpoints it so well. Like, yeah. No one died. Everything's fine. And actually, we're doing great. Thanks.
Right. So, yeah, we're not going to just talk about marijuana. I want to be clear about what we're going to do with this episode. I want to talk a little bit about this overall idea of paternalism, define what that means, and you know, briefly talk about how the state is involved in this kind of stuff, because that's really the basis of the war on drugs.
Right.
And then we want to discuss the essay, Why We Should Decriminalize Drug Use, by Douglas Hussack, though he's published this same essay by two different names. Another name for this essay is 4 Points About Drug Decriminalization. And Douglas Hussack is probably the leading philosopher to address the war on drugs. He's written a couple of books on it. He travels discussing it. He's been a consultant in various legal ways. So he's a good source of knowledge for this, just if you're interested in doing more later, of just Googling his name and looking at some of his works. And maybe we'll put some of his links up. But regardless, how about we start out with the idea of paternalism? You guys are familiar with this term, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
It has the word father, right, built into it, paternal. So the basis of the idea of paternalism is when you're trying to protect someone from themselves, but you're doing it not, you know, in a motherly way, traditionally motherly way, by, you know, being warm and caring. You're doing it in a traditionally fatherly way of the threat of punishment.
Much more 1984 way of doing things.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Or I think of like Beaver Cleaver age, you know, of the traditional family. The whole idea of, you know, wait till your father gets home kind of thing. The thing is that when you think about what the purpose of the state is, I mean, the two most obvious purposes of having a government are to protect citizens from outside, right? Other countries would be invaders. That would be the military and, you know, diplomatic efforts, things like that. And then an internal security force to protect citizens from other citizens. And that would be the courts, the police, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. It seems to me that without those two components, you really don't have a government. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah.
I mean, you got to have those two in some form in order for there to be a state.
And there's going to be some kind of rule of law for society to adhere to.
Right.
Right.
But the idea of paternalism is the state not protecting you from other people or other people from you. It's protecting you from yourself. Which, you know, initially, if you just stop and think about that, as far as, you know, a government protecting you from yourself, there is something weird about that. Right.
Although, have you met you, Norm? I mean, someone has to step in here.
I want to hurt myself. Well, so, you know, I've got on my notes here some examples of paternalistic laws. The most obvious that are often cited are things like motorcycle helmet laws or seatbelt laws. So, if, you know, if you live in a state, and I think probably most states have this now, that if you're not wearing a seatbelt, you can get a ticket for that.
Mm-hmm.
That law is not protecting anyone from any other person.
Yeah, you know, I never thought of it like that, but you're actually correct. It's weird.
Yeah.
Or the helmet law.
Right.
And, you know, in Colorado, I don't think we have one, do we?
We don't.
No.
No. Mm-mm. You're allowed to be an idiot in Colorado and ride a motorcycle without a helmet.
Well, Norm, you see, the seatbelt law protects you from projectiles in the shape of human beings.
Right.
That's dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, you made an interesting comment, though, because you just called people who ride without helmets idiots. But so does that mean that if it's an idiotic move, that it should be, there should be a law against it?
Well, that's the question, right? If something is really stupid for you to do, should we have a law to prevent you from doing that? And at least I just want to acknowledge that this is not a normal activity of government. This is at least something that is an overreach of what a standard idea of a government would
sure,
be.
Sure, but that's a it's our government is like that, and that is a – I mean, when you say normalized, I think that's what it
– I mean,
now.
The I idea mean, like conceptually.
Changed. Oh, okay, yeah.
Conceptually, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I've got a whole list of laws that are mostly paternalistic, you know.
It's against the law to kill yourself?
Yes, it is.
Had no idea.
Yeah, and look, you know, it's weird because how do you enforce this, right?
Right. Now, I can see the sale and the purchase of organs being against the law because that if it's not against the law, I can see someone coming after me to get mine and then make a profit.
Well, that's where – okay, yeah, she's looking at my list. You know, the sale and purchase of organs to avoid people taking your organs that's part of that law that – is not paternalistic. That would be protecting you from would-be,
right.
You know, organ theft, organ thieves.
Right.
But there's a paternalistic component to it because the concern would be that if you were poor, you would donate your kidney.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
Well, yeah. You know, there are a lot of people in the medical community who are actually making the argument that we should open up organ donation to be, you know, for profit or at least be financially, you know, based, and that therefore there would be a lot more organs available. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, someone doesn't have a whole lot of incentive to put on the back of their driver's license that they're an organ donor. But what if we made it to where when you are assuredly going to die, if you donate your organs, that generates money for your family?
Mm-hmm.
More people would be more likely to become organ donors.
Really, we're going to be able to, you know, 3D print organs in a few years. It won't even matter.
Right. But, you know, I don't know. By the way, the suicide thing, people would debate that, you know, and say, well, suicide's not illegal because it's not like there are a lot of statutes about that. But in general, most states, what they do is if you are unsuccessful in attempting suicide, the state will take you by force into a holding area and give you counseling and put you on a watch. And you can say that that is, you know, a benevolent thing to do, but it doesn't matter since it's not your choice. Then that is a effectively a punishment. So that makes it effectively illegal to commit suicide. Hmm. Really, it's attempted. Really
kill yourself.
Huh?
Then you really want to kill yourself.
Yeah, right.
A good example of a modern law that just got passed was those ones like in New York, I think, where they're trying to limit the size of a soda you're about to buy.
Sure, exactly. And
that is crap.
She loves she loves soda. Laura is a Diet Coke fiend.
Yeah. Bloomberg had a lot of nerve with that.
He was mostly trying to cut down on sugar intake.
Sugar, yeah.
But I wonder how it worked. Could you not limit the size of diet sodas?
I know.
No, I think.
Can you give me a pass on this?
But anyway, yeah, that's a perfect example. Just to be noted, though, sometimes it's hard to tell initially if a law is paternalistic or not. So, for example, you might think that I think this is now a federal law that if you run a fast food establishment, you have to show your calories of your meals and your menu items readily available. And so that's why, you know, when you go to Burger King or McDonald's or something like that, you see a lot of calorie counts now. I believe that's in response to a federal law. And, you know, it's not clear if that's entirely paternalistic or not. It might not be, because it might be protecting you from being harmed from not knowing what's in your food.
That would be my first thought.
Yeah. So
it just makes fast food more depressing.
I guess, you know, anyway. For example, laws that ban gambling, that would be another example of a paternalistic law. It's not protecting people from other people. It's protecting you from gambling, because gambling is not good for you. It's not smart. So, the list is fairly long of paternalistic laws, some of which are you know, more controversial than others. My personal thought is I'm not a big fan of paternalistic laws, but if the consequence is low and it's just a little bit of an incentive, then, you know, maybe it's a smart thing to do. I mean, how hard is it to put on your seatbelt if we add a little bit of an incentive that it's going to cost you a little money if you don't, and that results in a lot of people wearing their seatbelt? That doesn't really that doesn't have a whole lot of unintended bad consequences, you know?
But it is taking away a choice.
Yeah.
You know how my car, when you don't have your seatbelt on, it starts to beep light, and we call it the nanny car.
Yeah. You know? Laura's car is a Prius, and if you drive without the seatbelt on for like more than 3 miles an hour, it starts to go crazy.
Yeah. And I can't turn it off, and I think that that's ridiculous. And if I don't want to wear my seatbelt for whatever reason, I mean, it's built into the car now.
Yeah, but what possible reason would you have?
None of your business. That's the deal. It's none of your business.
You know, she wanted to drive to the mailbox and doesn't need a seatbelt for that.
Maybe there's a chafing issue.
Yeah, exactly. You guys don't have to wear bras. You have no idea. I'm multitasking.
The key to me, though, is that the majority of these laws, the consequences are quite low if you disobey them. So, you know, we can discuss paternalism proper. I mean, we could have an entire episode on it if we wanted to. But I think we can set it aside, because most of these laws are nudge kind of laws where they give you a bit of an incentive to not do something. The war on drugs stands out as a very different kind of set of laws than, you know, seatbelts or motorcycle helmets. That, you know, if you're involved in and caught buying or selling drugs, the cost to you is quite high. Mm. And this is the documentary that I used to have students watch that everybody here has seen, The War on Drugs, Winners and Losers. And I'll put a link to that on this episode. And there are a couple other documentaries out there that are emphasizing this same kind of problem. I think the most recent one I saw was a film called How to Make Money Selling Drugs, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm familiar with what they're talking about. That basically the war on drugs is very high stakes. You've got people in jail for very, very long sentences for what, you know, objectively could be regarded as very minimal, if really any, legitimate role in selling or buying drugs. And there are some absurd cases, you know, like the case of the woman who answered a phone from her boyfriend to give him the number of a lawyer. And that was enough to get her convicted for being put in prison for 10 years. And other kinds of similar laws or similar cases. Another case that's mentioned in the video of a guy who sent a package for someone else, put his return address and everything, and it had drugs in it, and they traced it back to him, and he went to jail for also 10 years simply for mailing a package.
Well, I'm sure there's not just one case of that.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, I'm sure there are many. And, you know, there is a website that has a lot of information about this. It's called Mothers Against Mandatory Minimums.
Yeah.
Because the real problem they're emphasizing with the war on drugs is that it involves these mandatory sentences. Federal guidelines tie judges' hands, right?
Yeah, they really do. And I studied that a lot in my criminal justice that I had to go through and stuff. I actually had one of my professors showed this documentary to me way back in school. So I had actually seen parts of it already.
Right.
Just a long time ago. And yeah, it's pretty problematic. It's kind of a mess in a lot of places.
Yeah, well, you know, we've created this escalating system of punishment around the drug use and sale. And it's kind of a ratchet effect. You're not very politically popular if you appear weaker on crime. So even if it might be the right thing to do, and I think a lot of police officers, police unions, and judges all think that the mandatory minimums are pretty bad, it's very hard to undo because politically it's not very attractive.
Yeah, part of this is that I wonder, in terms of all of the drug laws and the mandatory minimums, I have to wonder who's making the money off of it?
Well, yeah.
Because that's why I think it's still in place. And I think that that's why we have, you know, some of the statistics that you've made in your notes here about people in prison, and I forget the percentages, but I think it's, you know, 1.5, that was China's, but we have the highest documented incarceration rate, et cetera. A lot of it is due to the war on drugs, and I have to think that someone is banking on this, and that's why it's in place.
Yeah.
I just don't know who.
Well, maybe it's been a little while since you saw the documentary you're talking about.
Yeah.
It talks about this exactly. There's a movement, been a steady movement in the United States toward privatizing prisons. And so companies are running prisons, and they are making a large amount of money off of exactly this. And so that's where a lot of the money is going.
Prisoners. I mean, privatizing prisons that's enough for an episode just in and of itself.
Sure. Should they even exist?
Yeah, it's a strange concept. I mean, really the entire concept of the state imprisoning anyone or any kind of punishments that come from it, even if it's a necessary thing, that whole thing is a tricky thing to do, especially when you're talking about depriving people of freedom and locking them up.
Yeah, when you create an incentive for someone else to actually ensure that there are people who are deprived of their freedoms, that seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, if the government runs the prisons, they don't have a vested interest in their people staying in there. They have a vested interest in people becoming productive members of society again. At the very minimum, just economic producers in society.
Right.
If a company is making money off of the fact that you are in jail, well, that creates the opposite kind of incentive. But, you know, Laura mentioned some of these statistics. I just want to cover them proper. Yes, the United States has the highest documented incarceration rate and total documented prison population in the world. And, you know, so yay, we're number one. But the thing is that the next country below us is China. They have 1.5 million inmates. We have 2.3 or 2.4 million inmates. But China has four times our population.
Right.
So number two, China, for incarceration rate only has 18% of our incarceration rate. So,
well, maybe if they would try a little harder.
Well, it's not, again, it's not productive activity. Regardless, that's just, it's kind of absurd. I mean, there are 7.2 million people, that's one in every 32 American adult, who are in criminal justice supervision one way or another. And that term, by the way, criminal justice supervision, means they're either in jail, on parole, or probation, have an ankle bracelet, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the war on drugs, I usually take a very practical look at it as opposed to, I mean, I know that we're going to focus more on an ethical look at it, but I just look at, from a practical perspective, what are you trying to accomplish and what's actually accomplished? And that's usually what, in the end, kind of informs my decision on a lot of, when it comes to like how the government's run in general or how society is run on a governmental level.
Right.
A lot of times the practical reality of something is what really drives my ultimate opinion, regardless of what I think about it on a moral perspective.
Right. I understand that. What's interesting about this case is that the war on drugs fails on both accounts.
Right.
It doesn't, actually on multiple accounts, it doesn't accomplish what it's trying to accomplish. There's lots of information out there that shows that it doesn't actually significantly, or it's actually difficult to prove that it reduces drug use at all.
Yeah.
So it doesn't accomplish what it intends to accomplish. It actually raises the amount of addicts. What were you going to say, Nick?
Well, it also makes things way worse.
Right. It's counter this. So not only does it not accomplish, it actually creates other problems. This private prison problem is one. The other that the video mentions is that there are police departments that are profiting from the war on drugs. They are doing this through asset forfeiture laws.
Right.
That because of the kind of stink there is on drug sellers, and this escalation in enforcement of the war on drugs, most states, most cities or counties, they all have drug units that seize assets. Money, cars, boats, whatever, that are related to someone who is involved in a drug transaction. Right. And it can be as simple as buying drugs. And what people don't understand about the way these laws work is they can take money or your car or jewelry or other things from you, and they don't have to prove that it's related to drug use. You now have to prove that it's not related to drug use. Yeah, the burden of proof is on you, because that's considered a civil action, not a legal action. You're not being arrested. And so the way the law has been structured, again, reflects this escalation in enforcement and just creates an abusive system. And there there have been new, you know, I think there was a Frontline episode talking about this.
Yeah.
That it's disgusting. Are counties where, you know, police officers are just literally just taking money from people.
Yeah, it's gross.
That's the most problematic aspect of it. I mean, even more than the private prisons, which does bother me. This bothers me way more when it comes.
Yeah, and they don't even have to arrest you for drug use. They can just take whatever, and then
if they think it could be used for drug use, that's all it needs.
Sure.
Yeah. And this is nothing. We don't even mention really, you know, whenever you send someone to prison, a lot of times people say that they learn to be criminals in prison.
Sure.
Because of the way it destroys their life. They have trouble getting a job afterwards. Yeah. So there's like a really high recidivism rate that didn't really exist in someone before for, like, you know, just doing drugs or some kind of, like, you know, a drug offense might only affect that one person.
Right.
Now when they get out of prison and have nothing else to do, they might turn to crime, and that will affect other people.
Right.
It's just a weird sort of almost like Freakonomics way of where it just makes the problem worse in ways that you probably didn't anticipate. But now you have people who go to prison, and their families are also destroyed. So now you have people growing up in broken households without complete family units.
Right.
It also, I think, adds to a higher likelihood of someone running into trouble with the law.
Definitely.
So it's several vicious cycles on this, I think.
Well, and the final blow in this documentary of one of the effects of the war on drugs is that it's creating basically children in foster care.
Right.
Because fathers and mothers are getting arrested in the war on drugs. And some of these some of the women who are getting arrested are pregnant or become pregnant in the process of or during a trial. And if they go to jail, well, what do you do with the kid? Well, the kid ends up in foster care. And so they pretty much know that the effect, one of the side effects of the war on drugs has been a 10 times multiplier of the number of children in foster care. And in the United States, we have about 500,000 children in foster care and serve in the course of a year, coming and going, about 800,000 children.
Right.
Which is an extremely high number for developed state of the economic wealth of the United States.
Well, the system can't deal with those numbers. I mean, again, there's just so many stresses that are in place that are, I guess it's all the inefficiency.
Right.
Ironically, it's all the inefficiency I feel like that a lot of fiscally conservative people complain about that they don't like. But I feel like a lot of them are still the people who really support a lot of these drug laws being in place, which is kind of ironic.
Right.
I think that the issue that Norm brought up could be fixed by a paternalistic law around sterilization. So I'm just going to throw that out there. Something to think about and consider.
That would be a very different approach.
Right.
Stimulating, yeah.
But, look, all this stuff that we're talking about is one angle on the war on drugs. That, you know, it's ineffective and creates actually more problems than it solves. And that's, I think, a legitimate reason to question what we're doing and limit some of these.
I think that's been a question that's been around for, you know, the last 20 years, actually. I think it came to light soon after Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign, where people actually started to gather statistics around drug offenses.
Really?
And I will put it out there that I've not done the research, but I've been around since that time.
Right.
And either it's due to my age and becoming aware of these types of issues, or the conversation started nationally after those big pushes came around with the mandatory minimums, which I believe came around in the mid to late 80s.
Right. Yep.
Nancy Reagan's push was strictly mid 80s,
right,
during her husband's presidency. And I remember, I think that was when it started a national conversation around, because our jail population exploded.
Right.
So, I mean, the question has been around for, you know, it's not new. And part of me wonders, you know, we're having this type of dialogue, which I think is always constructive and necessary, but I don't know what is being done about it.
Well, what's one of the things being done is the first step, legalizing marijuana.
But it's still classified federally as, a class one drug?
Yeah. So, you know, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, I believe, have now all legalized marijuana. And that is a way, this is a part of the checks and balances that are built into our society.
Right.
That the federal government, one of the checks on it is the states and the state's independence. And so this is exactly what is happening.
When enough states legalize this, it'll force the government to probably do something about it. And it's going to be that they'll have to decriminalize it.
Right. And so that's part of the exactly what we're talking about, of things changing. This is a slow process, and a lot of people think that it's a generational process, that even if you have a good argument, you just have to wait until the previous generation is no longer in power, or no longer around, no longer voting.
I think it's definitely a generational thing. You can just look at the polling numbers. People who are basically 30 and under don't care.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just going to be a matter of time until, you know, the people who do care have aged themselves out of the conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let me pose this question to both of you gentlemen. As we're talking
She's
about
so
marijuana.
Formal.
Well, you know, very corporate.
Yes, question from the lady.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. So my question is that, you know, obviously living in Colorado, marijuana has been a topic of discussion and in the papers, in the news, et cetera. My question to you guys is, does it stop with marijuana? You know, what do you think about decriminalizing the usage and the selling of cocaine or heroin?
Yeah.
Or, you know, people tend to hear heroin and then everyone freaks out and they think of the 90s and Kurt Cobain and oh my God.
Sure.
But my own view is that all drugs should be decriminalized.
Yeah, and that's the subject that we're moving into.
Right,
exactly.
Okay. I'm actually curious about your own opinion outside of the paper.
I 100% agree in the one complete decriminalization of the act of getting high.
What about selling?
That is providing someone the ability to get high. And if that activity is legal, then it's got to be legal to sell the ability to do that. So okay. I'm all for legalizing the sale and use, possession of drugs. And it sounds weird. Someone who is not familiar with Hussack's argument, their likely reaction is, even if they're liberal, is mm-hmm. probably yeah. to think, well, that's crazy. No, I mean, you can't, don't legalize all drugs. Are you serious? You're going to legalize crack? I mean, you're going to legalize meth? I mean, that's stupid. What are you thinking?
Well, it's a nice little way for people to naturally select themselves out, I guess.
No, I'm not thinking that at all. No, and this is why we...
I agree with both of you. You know, when it comes to this, I'm all for just basically decriminalizing everything. And I think for largely the same reasons, you know. Like, look, what's he say about the Joker in The Dark Knight? Some people just want to watch the world burn. I really don't care if people burn themselves out.
Well, yeah. I mean, I understand that. But if you were in a position of power of trying to manage other people, I'm not sure that that would provide you a good reason to decriminalize drugs.
But I'm not in either of those positions.
Right, so, I know. But, you know, we have to think about this from a policy standpoint, not a personal standpoint, right?
I'm just saying,
flame on. No, I asked for a personal standpoint, actually, for both of you.
But in reality,
taking that to a construct.
It's kind of meaningless to think about it on an individual level because it really is a policy.
It is.
Understood, but I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I just want to know.
Yeah, and I think for Norm and I, it's always going to come back to some sort of social contract argument where there would have to be some kind of, you know, substantial risk posed to, you know, society.
Well, let's
get into the conversation of it being immoral, right?
Yes, and you know, I want to get into step-by-step what Hussack talks about in this essay because I think it's that important. You know, so we'll put a link to this essay up on the website. It's definitely worth reading because there's this, like I said, there's these arguments about the war on drugs that focus on the harm that is caused and that the war is ineffective. And those are interesting. What is, I think, great about Hussack's argument is he doesn't take that approach. He takes a completely different approach and still comes up with the same answer that drugs should be decriminalized. So what I like about this is it's not a normal way of thinking about the problem. And yet you come up with the same answer. So it makes it very powerful that, you know, for multiple different reasons and multiple different ways of reasoning, that drugs ought not be illegal. So he starts off talking about what decriminalizing means. I just want to say that if you read the essay, he repeats a couple of times that he is trying to limit his conversation about decriminalizing to use and not sale, but then he backtracks at various points. So I would say just forget it. He don't buy what he says. He's really talking about the decriminalization of both use and sale.
Right.
He clarifies possession of drugs because technically, you know, someone might say, well, using drugs isn't illegal. It's possessing them. And he says this is a silly distinction because you can't use them without possessing them.
I know.
Obviously.
I totally agree.
But the other thing that's a side note about this is that, you know, the reason why possession of drugs is technically what the laws talk about is because it traditionally has been easier to prosecute someone who has the drugs on them than it was to have to prosecute someone who has the drugs already in them because they've used them.
Right.
But that is changing because medical testing is getting better. And so now, and police are starting to use these devices that can test you for THC, the presence of other drugs right there on the spot.
Right.
There's definitely, out of those two, one is more fun than the other for the person who's getting in trouble. I'm just going to put that out.
Where
the
are the drugs more
there.
Fun? In right. your pocket or
ingested?
Oh, my God, that's hilarious. But anyway, you know, just as a side note, and this is something that was touched on in the documentary, one of the problems with the war on drugs is that people who overdose are afraid to go to the hospital or to an urgent care or an emergency room for fear of getting arrested. And in the past, that's mostly been an unwarranted fear. You could feel safe going to the hospital because their job is to care for you, and you're not going to get prosecuted because the drugs aren't on you. They were in your system. But now that is starting to change with medical testing becoming better. And so that's going to make it, if something doesn't change, that's going to make it to where more people are going to be afraid to go get treatment when they overdose. And that will mean that the war on drugs will kill more people.
Well, let's clear that up. I would assume that it's not the people who are overdosing who are afraid to go to the hospital. It's the people that they're with.
It's all of the above.
Yeah, are don't want to bring them into the hospital because then they're with someone who has ingested drugs. You might have drugs on you, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you just don't bring them with you, sweetheart.
You know, sometimes when you're overdosing,
leave
Norm,
them at home.
You don't have, you can't like pack a bag.
Laura, this is why we have Uber now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
Well, so anyway, what Hussack gets into in his section two, I think, is the most important. That section is called Best Reason to Decriminalize Drug Use. What he says is, look, the first of all, let's get one thing straight. What is it that drug laws intend to prevent? So what are they actually making illegal? And what he says, and really there's no better way than just to read what he says here. Because he's been talking about things that philosophers might be interested in about drugs and what they ought not get into. He says that, look, I'm not taking a purely libertarian approach, like you can do whatever you want with your own body. I'm not saying that. That I don't need to say that. But then he says, some drug prohibitions seem to violate deep principles that philosophers should care about. This becomes more apparent when you pause to consider exactly what it is that drug proscriptions are designed to prevent. Most drugs have a legitimate use. So drug consumption per se is rarely prohibited. And that's true, right?
Right.
So, you know, marijuana has multiple legitimate medical uses, some of which we're learning more about here in the state of Colorado, because now that it's legal, people can research it more, and we're learning about the different components of cannabinoids and different effects. And so it has legitimate uses. Opiates have obviously legitimate uses.
Yeah, like morphine.
Sure. A drug like MDMA, ecstasy, had a couple of medically practical or
therapeutic,
useful.
Therapeutic, yeah.
Sure. It was useful, perhaps too effective.
Norm, you can't have a rave without X.
Well, right, but that's not the medical use. Unless it's are we talking about raves at hospitals? Does this happen? Nobody told me about this.
Yeah, with medical glow sticks?
That's not fair. Anyway, his point here is that most drugs, in some contexts, are perfectly legal and treat a condition. So it's not the drug itself, in most cases, that is illegal. So here's what he says. Instead, the use of most drugs is prohibited only for a given purpose. To get directly to the heart of the matter, the proscribed purpose is usually to produce a state of intoxication or a drug high. In case there isn't any doubt, let me cite the California criminal statute regarding nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide, of course, laughing gas. That's what dentists sometimes use. That's a legitimate medical use. But there's a law making it illegal to use it. Here's what it says. The statute makes it a crime for, quote, any person to possess nitrous oxide with the intent to breathe or inhale for purposes of causing a condition of intoxication, elation, euphoria, dizziness, stupefaction, or dulling of the senses, or for the purpose of, in any manner, changing mental processes. So, just to continue with what Hussack says, the ultimate objective of this statute is to prevent persons from breathing something in order to change their mental processes. It is hard to see why this objective is legitimate in a state committed to freedom of thought and expression. If the activity is to do something to change your experience, why in the world would that be illegal? I mean, you do that when you go to a movie. You do that when you play a video game. You do that when you dance rapidly.
Drink a cup of coffee.
Right. Yeah. So something is amiss, is what he's saying here.
Well, we want people to have fun, but not too much fun.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Style it back a little bit.
Well, look, he's touched on, to me, the core pivotal point, which is that ultimately what is illegal is not a substance, it's the act of getting high. That is what is illegal in this country. And this is why they continue to add new drugs as they come up to the list, because it's not the substances themselves, it's the act of getting high. And anything that gets you high, it doesn't have, they claim, if it doesn't have a medical purpose, and they do it even if it does, but if it's mostly used for having fun, then it gets banned. It gets added to the schedule. And so the federal government adds drugs to the schedule all the time. So, yeah, I think he's touched on exactly something that is important, and that's what philosophers are good at, is getting to the heart conceptually of the matter. So it's the act of getting high that is illegal. And then his argument takes, I think, a really interesting turn. He says, okay, so what is my argument for decriminalization? Well, my argument for decriminalization is that nobody's given a good argument for it to be a criminal offense. The burden of proof is on them, not me.
Right.
And he's absolutely right. He writes this very well, that look, if you're in a free state, by default, if something becomes illegal, there had better be a good reason for it. Because you're taking away someone's freedoms, and that's the reason, you know, for a nation like the United States, that's the reason why we do most of the things we do as a state, is to protect people's freedoms. So if in that state you're going to take away someone's freedom, it had better be for a very good reason.
Right, and this appeals to me, and probably you too, I imagine, on, you know, just from my social contract perspective of looking at government and morality, for that matter.
Right.
That sort of thing resonates strongly with me.
Right. And so, you know, from that platform, he starts to talk about, okay, so he's got some points in here that just crack you up when you read them. So, for example, in one place he says, you know, when I'm at conferences and people come up to me and ask me to read, you know, academically legitimate material, not just fluff or partisan bullshit. Academically, you know, interesting peer-reviewed material on the other side of the argument, on keeping drugs illegal. You know, would you give me some references? And he says in this paper that, you know, I'm really academically an expert in this field. And when people come up to me and ask me this, I'm kind of almost a little bit embarrassed for the field, because there's not much I can tell them. Because there's just not much out there providing even an attempt to make a reasonable argument for why drugs are illegal.
No, most people just fall back on the social taboo of doing it.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And I think people use that just to get by having to offer any kind of deep, insightful reason for it.
Right. So, you know, what he does then is he just addresses a few reasons that someone might give for drugs being illegal. And he says this, you know, I'm not going to be able to address every cockamamie argument that comes my way that, you know, someone makes to, you know, cause drugs to be, to support the drugs are ought to be a criminal offense. That kind of puts me in an awkward position of what I call being a fly swatter. But he addresses a few of them. One is, don't we want to prevent people from harming themselves? And what he says is, guess what? Drugs don't harm people. They raise their risks of harm. There are very few drugs. If there were a drug that just automatically does you irreparable harm, right? Okay. Then maybe that would be a good reason to control that, like we do with dangerous chemicals, you know, strong acids. You can't buy those at Home Depot. Okay. Well, you have to...
Drugs don't hurt people. People do.
I was waiting, Nick.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that he talks about the statistics that what does he say here? Approximately 42% of our population age 12 and over have tried an illicit drug at some point in their lives. And only very few of these occasions have produced any harm whatsoever. Now, he's not saying that these drugs are...
That's a really general statement, though. That's hard to get into.
Well, the numbers, if you're talking about 42% of the population age 12 and over, there's 350 million people in the United States? That's ridiculously high numbers. That's, oh, what is that? I'm trying to do a little loose math. What is that? Something like 50, 60 million people?
Did you say 42%?
42%.
It's more than that. Yeah.
It's more than that. Great. And how many people are, you know, in rehab or in other things? It's nowhere near that number. Hmm. It's not, probably not even a million.
I don't know.
I, by the way, I do think it is a problem that there isn't that many people in rehab. I think there probably is, if I have my numbers right, there ought to be over a million people in rehab. But we're not talking about tens of millions.
True. Okay.
And rehab is, you know, someone wanting to get off of a drug. This doesn't mean that they've harmed their body with it. That's kind of different because, again, it's the same thing with cigarettes.
Right.
Cigarettes and other, you know, alcohol, those are addictive as well. So... You know, all when you look at the big picture, he's not saying these things are safe, but what he's saying is they don't just, you know, it's not like pouring acid into your mouth. It's taking a risk. How do we treat other ways of people taking risk? How do we treat, you know, hang gliders? How do we treat, you know, people who bungee jump?
Well, we go and we get their bodies whenever it doesn't work. Look, a lot of textbooks I read when I was in school looked at it from a perspective of...
I'm sorry, that was...
Think about it. You can't just leave them out there, Norm.
No.
Be a person.
That wouldn't be right.
Right? A lot of textbooks I looked at, you know, a lot of theories that people would propose about drugs being legalized would just say, like, yes, of course, if they were legalized, use would undoubtedly go up. But there's a difference between use and abuse. And I think that that's important to look at here.
Well, yeah.
So, like, when you're talking about things that could be harmful, like, it comes down to how you're using it. So,
sure.
You could use a drug without abusing it.
Well, you know, what we do with other risky activities is we regulate and we educate on safety. So, you know, you can't go anywhere on any mountaintop and take your hang glider. There are going to be places that they don't make it to where you can't access them. They put signs up saying no trespassing or no hang, you know, whatever, because this is dangerous winds. They'll put signs up to protect people or, you know, things for hikers or bikers or other things. So that's the way we treat risky behaviors. And if you broke the law in those aspects, you would have maybe a fine. It would be a fairly minor offense. And, you know, mostly it's just to try to protect people and educate people so that they're smart. You're not banning the activity entirely. There are other safer places that they can do it. But that's how we treat risky behavior. But it's not how we treat risky behavior as far as drug use. Yeah. So I think that's a salient point. But... I think the main part of his essay is under his section 4, which is predictions of bad reason to criminalize. And this is kind of what you were just talking about, Nick. Basically, what he's saying is, look, the best argument you can come up with for drugs being a criminal offense is that you feel that if you were to decriminalize all of them, then the harm from drug use would just skyrocket. There would be tons of people hurting themselves. And that would be terrible. And what he argues, and I think he does a really excellent job of arguing this, is you simply don't have enough information to make that argument. Nobody does. And there are reasons, there is actually information to suggest the opposite. And he makes three main points in that vein. One is if drug use is decriminalized, then that means that you can tax it. And so you can control behavior by taxing. If a particular drug is less safe than another, then you can tax it more heavily, and that can discourage its use. You really can't do that on the street. And by the way, this is one of the big problems with heroin and cocaine. Both heroin and cocaine are extremely cheap to produce. The profit margin on cocaine is something like 3,000%. if you have something that has a 3,000% profit margin, there's no way in the world you're ever going to stop that from being sold. So those things are – the prices are not related to anything having to do with regulation because they're illegal. So they can't be regulated by taxes. And in this country, we have a kind of we have precedent for having unusually high taxes for things that aren't particularly good for you or good for the environment. Gas tax being one, taxes, high taxes on cigarettes.
Cigarettes, yeah.
Right? So
marijuana.
Oh, yeah. Here in Colorado, the taxes on recreational marijuana are fairly high, aren't they?
I think they're 25%, if yeah. I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So,
yeah, so let's create ourselves a crack tax.
Well, hey, I mean, that's a way of controlling behavior. Yeah. But the second argument that he makes, I think, is the most powerful. And I'm going to put it a little bit different way than he does. So some of this is my own interpretation, but I think it's very well in line with what he's saying. That, look, if you remember that decriminalizing drugs is not decriminalizing the substances, what you're decriminalizing is the activity of getting high. What you're saying is, as a nation, this is not something that we're going to punish people, as the state is going to punish people for doing. So if you decriminalize the act of getting high, well, then what happens with the market? Well, okay, getting high is now legal. So that means people are going to be selling legally various means of getting high. And we can think of the drugs that are out there now, heroin, cocaine, variants of those, methamphetamines, etc. Those get people high. But the problem is that some of those are dangerous. They are too risky. He says, by the way, that we don't really have good data on how risky these kinds of drugs are because a lot of it is propaganda from the government. And I know this to be true. I've seen literature and posters that just have flat out lies on them about the harms that drugs cause because it's kind of to promote this policy of the war on drugs. When you clear that out of the way and you actually have real information, he thinks that once you do start doing research on these drugs, I bet you will find out that many of them are not as dangerous as you think they are. But it doesn't matter if they are, and they're on a legit market. Well, the drug being dangerous means that the company who produces it is opening themselves up to a lot of risk financially for selling a product that is dangerous. Products that are dangerous, you know, the consumers don't like. They sue the companies for harm from these kinds of things. You can actually just make it to where you allow drug companies who produce recreational drugs to be open to lawsuits for harm. So this creates an incentive for them to not produce harmful drugs. And guess what? The people who are going to get involved in this are going to be pharmaceutical companies. Because now there's this new market.
So now you're just a show for Big Pharma.
This episode of Norm's Conceptual Corner is brought to you by Pfizer. No, not kidding. I'm kidding. I don't have anything to do with Pfizer. Okay. So the pharmaceutical companies are going to get involved. They're really good at research. So they're going to make drugs that get you high and are quite safe. And that's in their that's their incentive, right?
Right.
So what I love about this argument is when you think about opening up the activity of getting high to being legal, then the drugs that are on the market are not even the same ones that you're thinking of now.
True.
I mean, if heroin really is as terrible as people think it is, and maybe it is, though there's some reason, by the way, to believe that heroin is not as dangerous as people think it is, but it's the things that heroin is cut with in the street because it's uncontrolled that make it so dangerous. But regardless, let's say it is. Then you're not going to be – it's not going to be easy to find at your liquor store or drug store. If it is there, it's going to be very expensive because it's dangerous. And so people aren't going to buy that. People are going to buy the other new drug that is out that gets you high that is safe. Yeah. So well, go ahead, Nick.
Another way you can look at this also is I think a lot of it will just be taken care of on a kind of like societal level where you don't need it to be illegal. For example, right now, if you go to work and you're drunk, you'll be fired.
Right.
And you're not going to be able to have income to support yourself.
Right.
So, I mean, that kind of – you know, it kind of takes care. It's without having a law, you have like a rule at work that kind of regulates your behavior. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are lots of other costs.
That sort of thing would happen, though. I mean, like, you know, if you are showing up at work and you're doped out on heroin, the same thing is going to happen.
Yeah.
And like, if we're assuming it's legal, you'll be fired.
This is an argument that John Stuart Mill made when he was talking about paternalistic laws. He basically said that, look, you know, a lot of your behaviors can cause public opinion or you know, your friends, the people around you to censure you. You don't necessarily need a law to add more salt to the wound. You're already going to get punished.
Right.
So yeah, that applies to this as well. But you know, there's this other element, and this is talked about in drug policy fairly often. There's this third part that Hussack mentions, and it's called the naughty factor. It's that when you decriminalize something, will that mean that some people who previously were afraid of getting arrested will now try that activity? Yes, of course it does. But it also means the opposite, that there are some people who would have done an activity who now that it is illegal – or now that it is legal will no longer because it's not cool to them.
It's not forbidden fruit anymore.
That's right. And so he talks about how, you know, it's difficult or impossible to estimate the net effect of this, but it could be just a wash that you just have different people. You have the same number of people using drugs, just some of them are, you know, new users and others wouldn't try it because it's not cool. Yeah. So,
and again, consider that there's a difference between using and abusing.
Right.
Like lots of people who – you know, like lots of people, I knew a lot of people who didn't drink before the legal age do. And
right.
Then after they were able to, they tried it and they still don't drink that much.
Right.
But they used it, but right. They don't abuse it.
Right. So the other component to this is taxing and creating a market on all this stuff can be used to fund proper education and drug treatment. And by the way, that's pretty much what's going on in Portugal. Portugal has legalized all drugs, I think, for the last 8 years now.
Are you for real? I didn't know that.
Yep.
Hmm.
And they've seen a reduction in overall addiction rates. They've seen a reduction in dangerous drug use. They've seen an increase in people in rehab, but their country now can take it. And so it's my understanding that most of the data coming from that is showing that the experiment is working well. Are there some problems from it? I think there are. I think most of the problems are tourism, and so that's people from the outside kind of going crazy. But as far as their own numbers, I think they've just been nothing but improved. And I believe that they have the same statistics from Amsterdam, where there are various drugs, not all drugs, but various drugs that are legal. And most of their problems are tourist as well. So look, it seems like from every angle, this is the wrong approach, the wrong way to handle the problem. What exactly is the problem to begin with? What are we trying to accomplish?
What are we actually accomplishing?
Yeah. And you know, when you add in this element of private prisons and other industries that are making a lot of money off the war on drugs, now you've got people who are talking about the prison industrial complex, like kind of in the same way that you know, in the past, people used to talk about the military-industrial complex. And that is a term that what that means is that it's very difficult to change things because there is this huge machinery making money off of it, this big, powerful industry.
Right.
Well, prisons and prison guards and prison guard unions, these are very powerful industries. Mm-hmm. And so it's when you start to think about these arguments for decriminalizing and the harm that the war on drugs is doing, and you think, well, why aren't we changing this? And one of the big reasons is because too many people are making money off of it. Too many people are invested in it, this industry.
Oh, yeah.
That makes it kind of sad. that yep. That we're engaged in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think this is a perfect topic for ethics. I don't know which ethical theory would support this. I'd think really almost none of them would. So it's almost like, you know, we had all those episodes about varieties of beliefs about how to look at what's right and wrong. And in this problem, it almost doesn't matter. It's hard to see how you can justify it no matter what.
Certain forms of divine command are the only way, like certain religions have prescriptions against doing.
Right, but there's actually nothing in the Bible about drug use, even though drugs were around.
Well, how the hell do Mormons do it?
What's interesting is that it has to do with the translation of words.
Oh, dear.
The words in the Bible, so for example, in the New Testament, the word for drug use is pharmakia. That's where we get the word pharmacy from. That word does appear in the Bible in a few places, but is not translated drug use because it also back then meant the practice of the occult. So it meant people who were, you know, possessed or people who were dabbling in, you know, playing, you know, contact with dead spirits or demons. And, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense.
So people who weren't doing anything.
Right.
Exactly.
When you think about it, in a world where they have no medical knowledge, no knowledge of chemistry, they don't even know what the elements are. In a world like that, if someone is acting weird after they eat a mushroom or after they inhale some leaves that they put on the fire, you think that they're possessed by a spirit.
Because, he's a witch.
Yeah, because they're acting weird. And they probably think that they're possessed by a spirit because they don't understand what's going on.
That's why we call our liquor stores wine and spirits.
Is it really? Where do we get the term spirits for alcohol?
I don't know.
I don't know that either. I wonder if it is because people act weird and they thought that they were possessed.
Let's just go with that.
I'm going to have to look that up now. That's interesting. But regardless, I do find it weird. Well, in Christian tradition, drinking alcohol is generally accepted. There are some groups who don't drink any alcohol, but they're generally fringe. In Christian tradition, drinking alcohol within moderation is okay. And the reason for that is because alcohol is mentioned a couple of places in the Bible, at least part of some of them are favorable. The most obvious example is when Jesus gave the wine to symbolize his blood. So Christians, drinking wine or other kinds of alcoholic beverages to them is permissible.
Right.
Yeah, there are passages that talk about drunkenness. So, you know, they generally consider it a value of, you know, you can drink, but don't get wasted.
Yeah.
But drug use being associated with the practice of spiritism because of the wording and because of lack of knowledge of drugs, well, that means that this was part of Christian behavior, early Christian behavior, not so much mentioned in the Bible, but part of Christian behavior to avoid any substance that we would call a drug because they thought that it would lead to spiritism. And by the way, many religions in the United States still think this. They still think that if you smoke pot, you are more susceptible to Satan. Or, you know, if you take a psychedelic, then you could end up being possessed and then not be able to get rid of the spirit. I mean,
I've thought that as well. It was in college.
Are you serious?
It was a bad time. It was not a good
you
night.
You had a time there that you were religious, but you didn't know. That was when
but
you were
not
younger.
In college. Oh, okay. Yeah, no. But I have had a time where I've been high and been worried. And did not. God, I had a bad experience.
That's terrible.
Maybe so we should get there.
Yeah. So anyway, I find it an odd coincidence that we live in a country that has these Christian undertones, and sure enough, we have a pretty liberal policy about alcohol and an ultra strict policy about drugs, more strict than probably most other countries. This is one of these things that I think the public and misconceptions fuel a lot of this stuff. And it's sad because, you know, you've got Otherwise, you know, you've got people who are in jail and they haven't harmed anyone. They haven't committed any violent offenses and they're rotting in jail.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I think that's pretty much our episode. I hate to leave on such a downer note.
No.
Wah, wah, wah.
I guess the bright side is it looks like we're in the middle of this exact issue, you know, going the way of changing. It's going to be slow, but it does look like it is changing. They are really looking at the mandatory minimums. They have revised the implementation of the mandatory minimums, at least to some extent. They're starting to become aware of the possibility of legalizing marijuana. So I think that we are living in a time where things are going to be changing, which is good.
I agree, but I don't think that we're going to see the legalization of all drugs in my lifetime.
Probably not.
I'm only 25, but still. Just kidding.
Well, look, if it makes you depressed, the good news is you live in Colorado.
Yeah.
Yeah, true, true. So
you and, can pick it yourself.
And, you know, my attitude is, you know, if you live in a state where pot is legal and, of course, you have other ways of loosening up like alcohol, do you really need – how many different drugs do you need?
Yeah, but that's not the point.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
But effectively, if marijuana were legalized nationwide, this would take a fair amount of the pressure off of the war on drugs. It would not cure the whole problem.
Right. But, it would be a huge first step.
Right.
But some people really like cocaine more than marijuana. Did you just say you're the same, Nick?
I said, I'm just saying.
Oh, just – yeah, exactly. Some people have preferences.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it'd be a huge first step. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think we've talked this one through. Be interested in what people think. We don't get a huge number of responses on a website. I think a lot of people listen and consider. I wouldn't mind getting thoughts on this one or any of the episodes. But you guys, thanks for having this conversation with me.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for listening out there. And please remember, use responsibly.
We all are fighting the same fight. We all are in the same war. We all are in the same revolution. Got to know what to fight for. We all fight the same fight. We all are.